Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Green for All conference call. It's my pleasure to introduce your host, the field organizer with Green for All, Julian McQueen.
Thank you, Jaylee. Hello, everyone. This is Julian McQueen. I'm here in Oakland on behalf of Green for All. I want to just take a minute to thank everyone for joining us today. We put out the call for this national conference call last week in hopes of getting a few dozen folks together to talk about upcoming action in Congress and framing the debate around climate change and our responsibilities and the efforts that we'll be making in the coming months. And we had an overwhelming response. We have over 300 people joining us from 44 states. So this is very exciting from our end. We're really glad to have you all. I just want to say briefly, if you have questions, unfortunately, due to the size of the call, we won't be able to take callers on the line and have live questions, but we would like your questions. Please send them to call@greenforall.org. Green for All is spelled out, all one word. Call@greenforall.org. Please send those questions throughout the call, and starting around 11:25, we will be taking those questions. And just to back up a little bit, let me just go through the agenda. So we're just going to do a brief introduction here, and then we're going to have Van Jones, our president, join us in just a moment to do a short presentation until 11:25. Then beginning at 11:25, we will start answering the questions that have been submitted via the email, and we will be wrapping it up right around noon. So I just want to thank everybody for joining us and just really appreciate the fact that this is a really pivotal moment in our history, and it's a very critical moment in our efforts to curb climate change and our efforts to revitalize our communities. There's huge opportunity that we have not seen thus far, and we really want to make sure that we are in a position to take full advantage and make sure that our voices are heard and our efforts are being recognized, and that we're able to make the change that we want to see through this process. So with no further ado, I want to introduce Van Jones, president here at Green for All, and please send us questions, call@greenforall.org, and Van, please.
Good. Well, first of all, thank you, Julian. It's been an awful lot of time getting this call pulled together. You know, we are, first of all, thrilled that so many people, especially after Memorial Day weekend, are ready to have this conversation. I know most people on this phone call are really busy, and ordinarily, you know, if there was going to be some, you know, environmental legislation being discussed in Congress, it would be number 597 on our to-do list if it was there to be worrying about it. Most of us do our work at the local level and have our hands full every day. But in about 2 weeks, a little bit more, a little bit less, Congress for the first time is going to take up in a serious way what to do about global warming. And this is not something that any of us can sit out. No matter what our main issues are, no matter what we work on most of the time, this is like the opening round and one of the most important things that's going to happen, you know, in this century. And we wanted to make sure that we at least got all our folks together on the phone and try to update folks, make sure we all know what's going on, why it's important, and then just some basic principles that we're going to be trying to move forward with and see if we can get some questions answered. You know, before I jump into that, I also want to acknowledge, you know, Green for All, you know, we're a national campaign, a national organization, I should say. We're working for green-collar jobs and opportunities. Our whole idea is we want to build an inclusive green economy that's strong enough to lift millions of people out of poverty. And so in our green economy, we don't have any throwaway species or resources. We also don't have any throwaway children or neighborhoods, and we want to be included in anything that's happening with regard to the green economy. And there are other organizations like One Sky, Blue Green Alliance, Apollo Alliance, or numerous organizations, too many to mention, that are also national organizations that are now focused on this debate that's coming up in Congress about global warming. We've got, you know, environmental justice colleagues all across the country, many of whom have taken a very principled stand against any of the kind of cap and trade provisions that are a part of this thing that's moving forward. We have friends in labor, some of whom are very concerned about, you know, jobs, impact on the economy. So this is gearing up to be a very major discussion. But this phone call that we want to do is not about the nuts and bolts and the details of the policy. The Warner-Lieberman bill, which is the bill that Barbara Boxer is going to bring forward, is like a phone book. I mean, it's got so much stuff in there that we could literally do a whole weekend teaching just on that. So we're not trying to analyze all the policy details. We're not even trying to take a position on, quote-unquote, Warner Lieberman per se, or the Climate Security Act, which is the other name for it, per se. We wanted to take a step back and talk about the politics of this whole thing and the values of this whole thing, and really get everybody positioned to, at least, even though none of us are going to necessarily become, you know, climate experts overnight, but to be able to speak from a position of strength and a position of clarity about what our politics are as people who are concerned about people of color, low-income people, young people, the vulnerable people, the marginalized people. Where are we coming from in this whole thing? Where do we stand? What are our politics? What are our values? And we want to try to, you know, to tee that up. One of the reasons we wanted to have a grassroots conference call about this is because so often not only do we leave ourselves out of the discussion, other people assume that we don't have anything to say about it, and they leave us out. And in this situation, it's either, you know, frame or be framed. You know, we've got to frame this issue so that we're included, or we're going to be framed out, or have people who have never even called us speaking for us, you know, and trying to represent our interests. Number two, again, nothing about us without us. We know that from grassroots politics. If we're not at the table, we're on the menu. So we have to make sure that we come forward with a strong position, at least in terms of that we have a right to be a part of this conversation and that we should be at the center of the conversation. So a couple of things. Number one, values. Then I want to talk about politics. From our point of view, the values that we should be standing on this whole thing are very simple, very familiar to us from all of our work at the grassroots level: equal protection and equal opportunity. Anything that Congress does to move the needle on global warming needs to consider to make sure there's equal protection for the most vulnerable people, and equal opportunity as we begin to move billions of dollars and billions of dollars of investment into all these clean and green solutions, that we also have equal opportunity. That's a place I think that all social justice groups, racial justice groups can stand as an opening position. We want equal protection and equal opportunity. On the politics of this thing, you know, there's really three ways for us to lose in this debate, and only one way for us to win. You know, we all know that global warming, I mean, I think most people on this call know that global warming is real, it's happening. You know, we got wacky weather. You know, the scariest channel on TV right now is the Weather Channel. You know, all kind of nonsense and crazy stuff is happening. You can't deny it. And we also know that our communities are the most vulnerable. Katrina showed that, you know, all the things that have been happening all across the country, the wildfires in California, Arkansas was underwater for, you know, a good chunk of the past few months, flooding we haven't seen before, droughts we haven't seen before. So we know that global warming is real, it's happening, it's causing climate chaos, and we're getting hit first and worst. So one way for us to lose is just for the government to do nothing. The first way for us to lose is for the government to do nothing. And that is what, frankly, a lot of the big polluters and other people still would prefer, that we just keep going on baking the planet. We say, as, you know, racial justice people, social uplift people, that it is a civil rights issue, it's a human rights issue for the government to take dramatic action to cut carbon. Our children are laying on the train tracks here. We want dramatic action. It's not just the Sierra Club and our allies in the mainstream white environmental community that are screaming about it. We are screaming about it. So number one, we could lose if government does nothing. Number two, we could lose if the government does something that, you know, impacts carbon emissions and pollution, but doesn't look out for the needs of low-income people and poor people. In other words, the government needs to do something, but number two, it needs to do something that minimizes our economic pain in the transition. The way the government is thinking about it right now, it's about trying to put a price on carbon. Well, those prices will tend to make energy more expensive. Energy is used to make everything else. It can make everything else more expensive, food, everything else. So when those prices start to go up, we need to minimize the economic pain, especially for the people who are at the bottom, the people who can't afford, you know, spending more money on, you know, home heating bills, more money on food, more money on driving their kids to school and trying to get to their second job. So the government needs to take affirmative, strong measures, and that needs to be built into and baked to any approach, affirmative strong measures to protect economically the most economically vulnerable. And there are some proposals that are floating around right now to give the bottom one-fifth of people in society a direct cash payment to help them make it through when these new costs start hitting. And that's something that we want to stick up for. So first of all, dramatic action. Second of all, minimize the pain for the most vulnerable people moving forward. The third way we could lose is even if the government takes dramatic action, and even if they look out to make sure that the most vulnerable don't suffer economically, we could still be in a situation where we do not maximize the gain for our communities. Once we start moving in this direction of a cleaner, greener economy, which we all want, there's going to be thousands of contracts, millions of jobs, billions of dollars on the table. Thousands of contracts, millions of jobs, billions of dollars on the table. And if you look at the last few years, this whole green discussion has not been inclusive. It has not created opportunity for us to be at the table. Most of the jobs and investments are not going to low-income people, people of color, the people who most need new investment and who most need new opportunity. So the third way we could lose is if the government fails to help us maximize the gain. And so what we're saying is that our values are equal protection, equal opportunity. We want the government to take dramatic action. We want the government to do it in a way, though, that minimizes the pain, i.e. ensures equal protection from what's coming down, but also maximizes the gain and ensures equal opportunity for what's going to be coming down. So those are places where I think that we can stand. Now, probably in the question and answer, we may take apart more of the what the particular policies on the table are right now. But the reality is you may be feeling like, hey, I can't pick up the phone and call my local reporter and say, hey, listen, we want to be a part of the story because I don't know enough. We're going to try to help, everybody learn more going forward. We're going to have some packs we're sending out. We're going to answer some questions here. But don't trip like everybody's an expert on this stuff but us. Don't trip like everybody already understands this stuff and knows what cap and trade and cap and auction, cap and dividend. Most people, most reporters are still trying to figure this stuff out. And we are just as qualified to step forward and at least put what our concerns are into the stories, talking to our civic leaders, talking to our community groups, and let them know what our hopes and our fears are as anybody else. So I think it's very important that we do that. The other reason that's important that we get ourselves into a position to speak from a position of politics and values is because of what we have seen happening in this overall green political moment. So I'm going to take a second to tell a little bit of story about what happened out here in California with Prop 187. I'm going to make a prediction about how the carbon wars are going to play out, and then I'm going to be quiet. But looking backwards and then looking forward, looking backwards, here's our big fear, is that we'll have a repeat in this debate in Congress of what we just saw in California. What we think may happen in Congress in 2 weeks and why we need to be loud and proud is in California, we had something called Proposition 87, not 187, the anti-immigrant thing from 94, but Proposition 87, a clean energy ballot measure that we had on the ballot here in 2006. Proposition 87 was actually a good idea. The idea was they're going to tax oil companies a little bit of money and then create a big old fund that would then fund clean energy research and clean energy investments. You're basically going to use money from oil to replace oil. And it was polling 70% approval. Everybody was excited about it. In the polling and the focus groups and this type of stuff, is a great idea. Then the polluters started to get into action to start eroding support. The proponents of Proposition 87, were basically from Hollywood. They were from Silicon Valley. They had raised $40 million. They had brought Bill Clinton out here to California. They had brought Al Gore out here to California. And they were just rolling inside their own big green bubble. But in order to be a part of the Prop 87 coalition, you had to put $30,000 on the table just to even walk in the door. Most people of color groups could not afford to do that. Most low-income groups couldn't do that. Central Valley, low-income white folks couldn't afford to do that. So everything was built around this kind of eco-elite. Then, because we weren't at the table, all the messaging was done by the eco-elite. It was all this clean energy stuff, and the future is going to be beautiful, and energy independence, all type of stuff. Wasn't talking about no jobs, wasn't talking about health, wasn't talking about air quality, wasn't talking about any of the things that hit people at the pocketbook level or the gut level. It was all this up-in-the-air stuff. So then what happens is, once we are moving ahead, the polluters jumped in. And 6 weeks out from the vote, they started buying ads in the black papers, the Latino papers, Asian papers, taking out radio ads in Central Valley, basically saying that this whole Proposition 87 was just, is just going to be a big green tax on poor people. That Proposition 87 is just for the eco-elite to fund their little hybrid revolution at our expense, and that all these taxes that are supposed to go to the oil companies are just going to be passed on to consumers, and we're not going to be able, you know, regular folks aren't going to be able to afford gas and to heat our homes. Well, there was no response from the eco-elite crowd because, you know, they were you know, in their own world, and the thing started dropping like a stone in terms of the polling numbers. The NAACP came out, the head of the NAACP came out and denounced Proposition 87 as something that was going to be negative for the African-American community. And other leaders did the same thing, and Proposition 87 wound up failing 55-45. Now, why was that a disaster? It was a disaster for two reasons. Number one, everything that the polluters were saying was a lie. The little tiny tax that was going to be put on California's oil companies, the same tax was put on by Texas, same tax was put on by Alaska, by Venezuela. Most places where there's oil being produced, they do tax it. They just don't use it for clean energy. We had never had that tax. We were going to do what everybody else is doing, and it was going to be for clean energy. And it would have probably had a 0.001% impact on the global price of oil, which is really what determines the price of oil. So basically, those taxes were not going to be passed along. But the other reason that it was so terrible in terms of what it did, it showed that you can create a backlash alliance between polluters and poor people, for lack of a better term, a backlash alliance between big polluters and vulnerable communities that can derail and knock out green policy, even in California. Now, what's going to happen in the other 49 states? What's going to happen in Congress in a couple of weeks? When we aren't speaking and we aren't at the table, the right issues don't even get raised. No, at no point during the Proposition 87 debate did anybody stand up and say, first of all, you're lying on the economics of it, but no, more importantly, good green policy isn't something that we're going to do to low-income people. It's going to be something we do for and with low-income people. We're the ones who are suffering with this asthma. You move to clean energy, you start closing these power plants, our children can take these asthma inhalers out of their pockets. We're the one who needs the new jobs. We're the ones that need our homes weatherized. We're the ones who could have both contracts and employment opportunities, installing and inventing and investing in all of these new technologies. Nobody stood up and said this is something that would be good for us. And instead, polluters wound up speaking for us and organizing us against our own interests. This could happen in 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, we could be in a situation, and this is kind of moving forward, we could be in a situation, and I predict that we will be in a situation, where big polluters, people who have been enemies of our community, people who have, you know, we had to sue just to even, you know, get them to put a little scrubber, you know, on a smokestack somewhere, will be up and, you know, crying on TV talking about how Warner Lieberman is going to destroy the economy, Warner Lieberman is going to hurt, you know, low-income people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And right-wing Republicans, and frankly, you know, some blue dog Democrats who haven't been there for any low-income issues, are certainly going to try to wrap themselves up in the mantle of low-income people's needs, people of color's needs, and use that to beat back on Warner Lieberman. Now, I don't think that Warner Lieberman is perfect. I think there's a lot of things in it that need to be fixed and need to be changed and need to be adjusted. But we should make those arguments for ourselves, you know, to our congresspeople, to our local, you know, newspapers, to our community allies, to the national press. We should speak for ourselves about what those things are and not be tricked or used by people who basically mean us no good. So how do we do that? How do we move forward? What our big hope is, what our big aspiration here is that all of us are equally ignorant, frankly, on this call about how this thing is going to shape out and how to be heard. But we believe that the network of people who are on this call, and we believe that the network of people who we know can't step up to the plate. We've stepped up to the plate on other stuff that was, you know, hard for us at first, and we became quickly the experts. Everybody on this call has had that experience. But we want to create an opportunity for us to begin to approach our local media when these stories start getting run about climate change and say, we have something to say about that. We want for Warner Lieberman and Barbara Boxer to consider to make sure that we're protected and that we get good things out of it. And we want to help each other in doing that. That's our hope and our aspiration, is that there'll be a new force that enters this debate, a new force that enters this discussion. And it'll be people that they're not used to hearing speak about this stuff, and that other people won't speak for us. So that's the basic opening and introduction. I want to say one more thing about how we deal in this environment where, frankly, Warner Lieberman and Barbara Boxer is going to be getting hit from the left and from the right. There are going to be people on the left saying that this thing is, doesn't go far enough. There are going to be people on the right trying to fearmonger, saying it's going to destroy the economy and it's based on junk science and it's stupid. And it's just going to be a big food fight. The way I think that we have to look at this thing is, because our communities are most vulnerable no matter what the outcome is that we're playing chess, not checkers. We're playing chess, not tic-tac-toe. We're playing a long-term game here. And I think that there's some political and moral principles we need to consider. One is, whatever somebody like a Barbara Boxer, who's a liberal senator from California, does or doesn't do, if she gets completely decimated in this thing, there's nobody else in the Senate that we can really turn to who has her seniority to help us next year. The reality is this year the thing probably won't pass because it's going to be a big food fight and Bush is going to block it anyway. But so this is kind of year zero of the carbon wars. Next year is really year one. So again, trying to be savvy about this. This is year zero where everybody's going to start trying to define the issues. How this conversation starts is pretty much going to determine a lot of how it ends up. So we want to get in there and help to define the issues, you know, in June to make sure that our voices have been heard, grassroots, national, whatever. Chances are it won't pass anyway. But if we create a situation where people from the right have destroyed Barbara Boxer and other people who were, you know, tried to move this thing and we've done the same thing, I think that's not the smart way to go. I think there's got to be a way for us to support the people who are trying to get something done without necessarily supporting everything that they're trying to do. And that's going to require some political sophistication on our part. People are going to say, are you for this or against it? I think some of us are going to take the position, we're for the people who are trying to move the thing forward, but we have real concerns and criticisms about what's getting moved forward and figure out how to do that right and well. So that's the political calculation that we need to be able to figure out how to make, because next year we're going to want to figure out a way to make sure that we've changed the climate, changed the discussion, so some things will be on the table next year that aren't on the table this year. The second piece is just the moral piece of it. It's going to be very easy for us, people on this call even, may not agree or see eye to eye on every line and provision of some of these federal bills. And it would be very easy for us to start name-calling and fall out with each other and undermine each other or otherwise make it harder for us to work together next year when the real deal goes down. My hope is that, and frankly, you know, just we're all friends here, you know, there's a lot of that that's going on in the quote-unquote mainstream white community, there's a white environmental community. There's a lot of division. There's a lot of name-calling, a lot of nasty stuff on blogs, a whole lot of negative stuff that's going on. And it hadn't even got to the floor yet. My hope is that the racial justice, social justice community will set an example, a moral example of how to deal with something, because, you know, again, we have the most at stake here, how to deal with something that's complex, how to deal with something that's hard, but deal with it from a point of view where, you know, the most important thing is the outcome for our communities, and that we show that there's a way, even when we disagree, to do it with dignity, to do it with respecting each other, and frankly show some moral leadership to the whole country by the example that we set as we begin to engage. So, you know, that's my opening spiel. I appreciate everybody being on the call. We'll now stop and hear questions. And I'm sorry everybody can't talk. We thought we were going to just get on the phone and talk, but then there's so many people who wanted to be on. There's no fair way with 350 people or whatever it is to pick who can speak. So we just figure everybody can have an equal opportunity to email, and we'll just go through the questions that way.
That's very good, Van. Thank you. I'm Mahfah Malik, and I'm operations manager at Green for All, and I'm here trying to pull together some of these questions. Once again, sorry, everybody. I mean, it's great that we've got all of you on the phone here. Unfortunately, we're not going to have a chance to have each of you ask the questions that you want to ask. So we're trying to pull together some of the ones that are really similar and some of the recurring themes here to get some good questions out here. So we've got, from Pittsburgh, we've got Amy asking, she says, I understand that these are jobs that could help lift folks out of poverty. What I don't understand is why people think that large numbers of these jobs will go to poor folks. There are many unemployed, underemployed, and those who want to be reemployed in their field who are already skilled in various trades and manufacturing. So So why do we think that they are not going to be the first to line up for these green jobs? They're already skilled in, for example, manufacturing steel for automobiles. Why wouldn't they be the first hired to manufacture steel for wind turbines?
That's a great question. The simple answer to that question is they will be first unless we do something. The whole reason that we have to organize and the whole reason that we have to mobilize is because up until now, we've been banging, those of us who, you know, like myself, been trying to get kids out of jail and into jobs for years, people who've been trying to get economic development going in our communities for years, we've been banging on the door of a closed, pollution-based economy that's already kind of settled out who's going to be in, who's going to be out. What we're saying is now, since there has to be a transition, it's kind of like, you know, when you break up with your girlfriend or your boyfriend or whatever, it's like after you do that big breakup, the next day you're like, I'm going to the gym. I'm going to stop smoking. You know, once you make a big change in your life, then you can start changing a bunch of other stuff. We're saying we're about to break up with oil, about to break up with carbon. Let's break up with some racism and some poverty, too, and continue to try to jump into this conversation. It's not an automatic, but we do have legislation in Congress. We've been trying to get some things stuck into the Warner Lieberman and other bills in Congress to try to create what we call green pathways out of poverty. So there can be a focused effort and a sustained effort on the job training and getting our folks, especially our young folks, our folks who got convictions on their record, our folks who are hard to employ, get them off of the back of the line for the last century's pollution-based jobs and move them to the front of the line for the new clean and green jobs. But it's going to take a loud voice and a strong effort to say, we want the green economy. We fought in the last century to integrate racially a pollution-based economy. We want this new economy to be green and inclusive from the beginning. But it's not an automatic. It will take us all working together and calling for it and pointing out the racism and the classism in the emerging green economy where it's still being shaped, because that's where we think we can have the most impact.
That's very good, Van. Thank you. Thank you. And I'd like to also say at this time that if you do have questions, folks, please email them right now to call@greenforall.org. That's call@greenforall.org. And hopefully we can get to as many questions as we can here, so I'll move right on to the next one. So there have been quite a few questions about federal legislation. So, Van, can you just please tell us the situation of the Green Jobs 2007 bill that was passed last year and how we can get it funded? That's part of it. And people are all also wondering if the climate change bill is going to pass, and if Green for All is supportive of this bill.
Good, two questions. And also there are, later on we may hear from our policy directors also on this call, but I'll take these two. The Green Jobs Act of 2007, for people who are aware of it, was something that we got smuggled into the energy bill that passed and was signed into law by George Bush. A lot of people worked on that. The Apollo Alliance worked on that. The Workforce Alliance worked on that. Green for All, the Ella Baker Center. It's a lot of different, you know, it was a big effort. Speaker Pelosi encouraged Hilda Solis, a congresswoman from California, and Representative John Tierney from Massachusetts to lead on that. Senator Clinton, Senator Sanders jumped in. So it wound up being a good push, and we were able to get the Green Jobs Act 2007 authorized in the energy bill. What does it do? It authorizes $125 million which is every year, which is enough money to train about 30,000 to 35,000 people a year in green trades, getting federal dollars through the Department of Labor down to community groups who can do this good training. And 20% of those dollars are set aside. 20% are set aside for what we call green pathways out of poverty. And that is, again, a targeted special effort to make sure the people who most need the jobs can be connected with the jobs. Well, it turns out in Congress it's a three-step process. Well, it's a two-step process in Congress and a three-step process with the federal government to get those dollars out the door. We won the first round, which is authorization. The second round we're in this year is appropriation, getting them to actually put the money aside. We're going through that process right now. We need people's help talking to Congress, their congresspeople, et cetera. And then the last will be allocation. You know, once the Department of Labor has the money, they got to actually, you know, write the checks. So it's going to be a while. You know, it could be anywhere from 12 to 24 months before anybody sees that money. But we're encouraging local people to go ahead and start their own green job programs and expect the federal government to come in later with a big push. With regard to the climate change legislation that's on the table right now, the Climate Security Act, so-called Lieberman-Warner, that Barbara Boxer is going to be the main champion for, you know, we're still studying it. There are parts of it that look good. There are parts of it that don't look that good. You know, our fundamental view is, you know, we're glad that somebody is doing something, and we know, you know, that the leadership is trying to move. It's going to get beat up real bad. So we appreciate and respect their work, but we do have a lot of concerns. And our view is, again, this is kind of year zero of the carbon wars. Next year is really year one, where it really is going to all come down to the mat. We feel like it's important in this year because we don't think that it's likely to pass. It's certainly not likely to pass to get signed into law by this president. We think it's important for us to mainly go on record with the things that we think have to be in any final climate deal. Any final climate deal needs to have dramatic cuts in carbon, needs to minimize the pain and have equal protection for the most vulnerable people, and needs to have equal opportunity to maximize the gain for those same communities. And if the deal does not have that built into it, we will have to oppose it. And we think that there's no reason for it not to have those things into it. We think it makes it a better climate deal for everybody if it has those things in it.
And let me add something. This is Jason Walsh. I'm the National Policy Director for Green for All. One of the ways in which Senator Boxer has strengthened the bill, she recently released what it's called a manager's amendment to Warner Lieberman that will be introduced probably actually as soon as next week on the floor of the Senate. At least that's what is scheduled at this point. Could be delayed. We don't know at this point. One of the things that's been included actually is a pretty substantial investment in the Green Jobs Act itself. So these numbers will sound a little ridiculous because they're actually they actually run through 2050 so we're talking from 2012 to 2050, about 38 years. But the investment, if we take a particular estimate about how much the emissions are actually going to be priced at, would put a little over $60 billion over the course of this legislation into the Green Jobs Act, which is a fairly substantial investment. Another program that is funded, again, within Senator Boxer's manager's amendment is the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant Program, which, like the Green Jobs Act, was put into the energy bill that was signed into law by President Bush in December. These are grants that primarily go to cities that can be used for building and home energy conservation programs, energy audits, fuel conservation programs, just wide-scale retrofitting at the city level. It's our thinking these can create tens of thousands of green-collar jobs that are accessible to low-income city residents who most need those work and those careers. So, again, as Van said, there are a number of problems with the legislation, but there are also some, I think, really promising investments in there that we should be applauding Senator Boxer for.
Very good. Very good. Thanks, Jason and Van. We have got, we've got a question here from John Love, and his question is, a few folks have asked about how to forge a counter-alliance to the backlash alliance that you were speaking about earlier. So what is our message to them? What's our message to the eco-elite?
Well, I mean, the good thing is that, you know, the eco-elite, for lack of a better term, you know, they're not the enemy. I mean, it's you know, they are allies. It's just we haven't been operating as allies, and I think that, frankly, to our detriment as a racial justice, social justice movement, and to their detriment, because at the end of the day, whether you come in talking about the polar bears or whether you come in talking about the lack of jobs and opportunity in our communities, the answer is the same thing, which is a green economy that's strong enough to lift people out of poverty and include everybody, so that we are, you know, we're strong enough to make this transition. So I think that, you know, the most important thing about, I think, coalitional politics, as most of us know, is everybody has to get something positive out of the deal, and it has to be a good deal for everybody. And we don't want our community's interest to be a political football by either the eco elite or the polluters. I think people on this call are very experienced in how that whole thing can go down if we aren't clear about what we want and what we need. So I think that labor has to become a good partner. Our view is the labor movement can become bigger, browner, and greener as we go through this process of transition to a clean and green economy. But they're going to have to open their doors and include more people from our communities. They're going to have to be willing to embrace green technology. But that's their only future. They're either going to be bigger, browner, and greener, or they're going to continue to get smaller. We think labor can be a good part of this, and there's people in labor who want to move in this direction. We think, frankly, progressive business folks, green entrepreneurs, who right now need a lot of help from government, we should be able to say to them, hey, we're happy to make sure you get that help, but you need to also have equal opportunity and anti-poverty as a part of your business plan in terms of including more people in your workforce and in who you contract with. Certainly the mainstream environmental community has come around to the idea of green jobs. Our view, it's easy to say it. It's hard to make sure that somebody gets the job. And so we want to make sure that the environmental groups that are now saying green jobs tactically also follow through strategically and in a real way. And then obviously, the big alliance that we need is the alliances on this call because, frankly, we're racial justice, social justice people don't work closely enough together because we've been so fragmented in all these little fights and local struggles that here's a very big fight that could deliver billions of dollars to our community. Our hope is that we'll be able to find a way to work together on it.
That's great, and that actually segues into another question that we're finding here a couple of people asking about is how we can leverage the power of online social networks like MySpace and Facebook, and I know there's a bunch out there now, and how can we leverage those to maximize all participation, especially youth participation, in framing climate protection policy?
Well, I'm going to have to be honest. I don't know much about the MySpace and the Facebook. I'm learning, so I'm not the expert on that. But what I do know is that part of what we have to do is to make sure that our folks are having this conversation wherever, whether it's church or mosque or synagogue, whether it's black radio, community newspapers. There shouldn't be a single city with a progressive newspaper or a black newspaper or a Latino newspaper or any people of color or lesbian, gay, any of our media outlets that we can have direct access to that's not talking about climate in terms of how we can help our communities and what the dangers are, they're lagging. And we need to really, reach out to all of the media outlets that we have opportunity to reach out to. And a lot of what I'm hoping is that just us on this call will be like, oh, okay, actually I could get my local, newspaper, my local community station to put us on or to give us the microphone for a minute to talk about this or to assign a reporter to try to break this down, what does this really mean, and begin to educate our community so that as these things come to vote, this is just the first scrimmage, there's going to be other votes, more and more our community has the capacity to say, nothing about us without us. We want our fair share of the billions of dollars, and our communities need to be protected. No more Katrinas. No, and also, don't leave us to drown on dry land economically by sticking us with high cost and no benefits.
Thank you. So another few questions that we've had come in, again, recurring, are asking about cap and trade. So we have folks asking if you could explain the problems with cap and trade. Should our organizations be supporting a carbon tax instead of credits, and what are the pros and cons of these?
I'll take a crack at it, and then I'll let Jason or anybody else on our team take a crack at it. Our whole view about this is, very different. We feel like our principles and our values are what we call cap, collect, and invest. There's some people who are saying, right now Warner Lieberman reflects the idea that they should that the main problem here is a problem that carbon is basically free to dump into the air. And you got to figure out some way to have a price mechanism in there because otherwise people just will keep doing it. And so their idea with Warner Lieberman is to say, okay, well, if you limit if it's something limitless, it's by definition is free, and if it's free, it's cheap, and nobody cares about it. If you put a limit on it, if you put a cap on how much carbon can come out, then all of a sudden there's some value there, and then people can buy permits and trade them around, and then people will say, I don't want to buy those permits, I'll just start cutting my own carbon. So that's the idea behind Warner Lieberman. Some people say that that's not a good idea, because what's wrong with that is, first of all, it sounds like a big business swindle, and people are going to be basically trading in pollution permits, and shouldn't we just be cutting pollution out and not using these so-called market-based mechanisms? And they also will point to the fact that in Europe, they tried that, and it didn't work out very well. Other people will say, well, that we made mistakes in Europe, we learned in Europe, we're going to try to go in this direction. What gets proposed against cap and trade is something often called carbon taxes. Let's just tax the stuff, and that way you can get a price in there, and hopefully that will then make people say, hey, this stuff is too expensive, I'm getting taxed on, I'm going to go toward cleaner solutions. Some people say what's not good about the taxes is that the government is then just kind of guessing and giggling about what the price should be. Should it be $1 a ton, $20 a ton, $100 a ton? And then maybe that'll bring the price, maybe that'll bring the carbon down, maybe it won't. It's a little bit too imprecise. And so people go back and forth, cap and trade, carbon tax. Some people say, okay, well, let's make sure that with the cap and trade stuff, we call cap and auction, to make sure that at least when people are trading these permits, they have to pay for them, that money is captured, make the polluters pay. These kind of conversations are hard to do in this format. But our view about it is this. We say cap, collect, and invest. We want a big cap on carbon. We don't want, crazy, let's just guess. We think the science, people at One Sky have been screaming about this. The science is very clear about what kind of reductions that we need. So we want the government to introduce those reductions right away and start telling these big polluters they got to cut it out. Then we say collect. Now, we don't know. We're not economists. We're still learning like everybody else. Should the collection be from a cap and auction system? Should it be from carbon taxes? We don't know. But the polluters need to pay some damn money. That's what we know. We need to collect money from the polluters through whatever vehicle makes sense, so that then number three, we can invest in our communities. We can invest in weatherizing our homes, creating jobs for our folks, invest in good technology that's going to get us off of this suicidal pathway that we're on. So, a lot of the debates right now are happening at a level of kind of policy and philosophy that we're still getting our heads wrapped around. But what we say is, at a basic principle level, we want a strong cap. We don't want, the polluters are going to say, we want a cap, but we want a bunch of holes in the cap. No, we want a strong cap. Cut it out. Bring the carbon down. People are going to say, well, it's fine, but the polluters shouldn't have to pay anything, because if they pay anything, they're going to pass along the cost, and it's going to be bad for everybody. Don't let the polluters pay anything. Give them a bunch of free rights to permit, rights to pollute people. We say, no, you've been getting subsidies all these years, billions of dollars. Y'all need to pay. And we believe there's a way to do that, that if you take that money and invest it properly, we'll create, number two, three, invest, we'll create more jobs. We don't want big giveaways to big polluters. We want that money to go into investing in our communities. But we feel like there are true racial justice discussion, social uplift discussion, social change discussion hasn't happened yet, because it's all been trapped in this whole kind of ping-pong stuff which most of us can't understand. But we know at the neighborhood level, we say, listen, cap the polluters, make them pay, and invest that money in our communities. Most people can get with that. And that's not what Warner Lieberman says right now, by the way. So we're trying to fix that.
Thank you. Thank you, Van. I know we're cutting it close with time here, and I think we have time for about one more question. And so what I'm going to try to do here is pull together a lot of the sentiments that have been coming through in a few of these questions. We have folks like Susan Besson, I don't want to butcher your name, saying, give us marching orders. What does our to-do list look like if our national debate starts resembling the Prop 87 debate? We have Eric Bradshaw from the Fresh Start Community Development Corporation in South Carolina asking what we should do to begin at a grassroots level. Where, we have folks asking how they can help spread the message and how they can really work to get a good climate policy for our people in place. So people want to know what to do.
Great. Well, luckily, Julian is going to come on and take some of that on. and you know, we can invite him in earlier than the time that he was allotted. You know, in terms of people who are saying, listen, we get it, we knew that, that's why we got on the call, you know, what are we supposed to do, brother? You know, three things. You know, number one is, you know, our communities right now, if you go and talk, you know, barbershop, nail salon, you know, bus stop, our folks are not paying attention to this. So we think that number one is engaging your local media, you know, not just the kind of, you know, community-based media, but, you know, local TV stations, having editorial board meetings, going and sitting down and talking with the editorial board in your hometown paper and saying, hey, you know, we want to talk with you guys about what low-income communities need out of this climate deal. And even though it may not be in there right now, you know, this is you can help to shape that debate and discussion. We just did this in Minneapolis last week, and it was a really great meeting. They had never heard this perspective before, and they were excited, frankly, to have a new perspective on it and a new way to cover it. So, number one, engaging with your local media, and we're going to give you, we're going to be sending a media toolkit in the days to come to help people do that. And people want help with that. We want to be here to support. Number two, you know, everybody has, you know, a congressional rep, a congressional office in their community. Maybe some of you are powerful enough to actually meet directly with the congressperson. That would be great to really sit down and talk with them about, hey, this is, you know, this climate legislation is going forward. Maybe we're for it. Maybe we're against it. Maybe you should vote for it. Maybe you should vote against it. We know that this is not the last bill. There's going to be other ones. In the next ones, we want you to introduce amendments. We want you to put forward legislation that will explicitly take on the needs and the concerns of our communities and build that in and bake it into the next climate deal. Because, again, this is chess, not checkers. We want to make sure that we're using this as a moment to begin to create relationships with these congressional offices and, frankly, other city officials and, other public officials. And then number three, you know, we want to stay engaged. We had no idea we were going to have 350 people on the call. That's why it's kind of more of a monologue than a dialogue. We want to find ways to continue to educate this community and to educate ourselves and how each of the people on this call educating each other about the perspective that we should be taking and how it is that we can begin to educate our community. We want to create a quote-unquote community of practice where we can share talking points, teaching tools. There are people on this call that know more about some of the questions that were asked than, you know, me or Jason. How do we create a, you know, online where people can get those talking points, get those teaching tools, get those press releases moving around? We want to use our website for that and take advice and guidance from you about how we can best serve. But we felt like, hey, this thing is coming. It's going to be a big deal. We don't know all the right answers and everything to do, but minimally, let's get everybody in a preliminary conversation so we can get started. But I would say engage your local media, talk to your congressional representative, and then engage with us to get the best thinking around to everybody so everybody doesn't have to start from scratch.
Yeah, let me just add a little bit to that. Again, this is Jason Walsh. I second everything that Vanda just said. On the second point, which is talking to your congressional representative, one of the things we'll be sending out to folks after we send out the media toolkit in a week or two is an action alert asking folks to actually set up meetings with their members of Congress to start talking about this stuff. And part of what we want to remind people of, and we will remind them in that action alert, is that the entire game is not the cap-and-trade Lieberman-Warner debate, right? There's also an appropriations process that's going on where we are trying to get funding for some of the good stuff that was in the energy bill that was signed into law in 2007. That includes the Green Jobs Act, and I mentioned earlier that it gets funding through Lieberman-Warner, but we also need to pursue it through the appropriations process as well. It includes the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant Program, which we want to get appropriated as well. So these are conversations that need to be happening right now with members of Congress. I think there also needs to be a conversation that brings this back into local neighborhoods and local communities to make it clear to folks, to members of Congress, that green-collar jobs are real. They are already being created across America as communities recognize that these jobs can fight poverty and pollution and global warming at the same time. The message we need to be delivering to members of Congress is that we need their help to bring these to scale and to make sure they're happening all across the country.
Let me just say one thing just to make sure nobody is confused. The Green Jobs Act of 2007 needs to be appropriated, period. So, you know, we went and told Barbara Boxer's staff, well, you know, if you're going to put together a climate bill, you know, you should make sure that climate bill can help fund this stuff. But our fortune and our fate is not tied to Warner Lieberman. Warner Lieberman can fall or fail. We still have a process and a plan to get the funding for the Green Jobs Act and other green jobs legislation. So I just want to make sure nobody thinks that we're, you know, that tied with the thing. We want anything that they do to include green jobs, but that's true for any bill that goes across the desk of the president, should include green jobs for our communities.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both very much. I know that we do have limited time, unfortunately, but I think we may have time to answer one more question, and then afterwards we can bring Julian back on to speak more about the toolkit that you folks brought up earlier. So we have a question here that says, Van, you mentioned chess, not checkers, and there have been and we're wondering, how do we support our strong allies like Barbara Boxer, who might get beat up a little bit?
Well, I mean, every group is going to have to take its own view of this. I personally just feel that strategically it's bad to sack your own quarterback, which happens too much in our progressive, you know, communities and stuff. You know, I think she's trying to be the quarterback. She's sticking her neck out there. I think that we need to whatever we say, I think we need to make sure that people know that we appreciate, you know, anybody who's trying to lead on this stuff. And I think we can also say that you know, we have needs that are not being met, and we want them to be met. I will say this, you know, at a personal kind of human, at a moral level, the tone that we set coming forward, if we kind of have that Mandela kind of, you know, dignified tone of keeping, you know, this is about the children of all species, the grandchildren of all species, you know, and our children, you know, lives on the line, and conduct ourselves with that kind of dignity in our public discourse, that it will hopefully calm some of the waters in this debate, at least on our side. And I think in a more calm water environment, we can probably be more creative together across all these lines of race and class and come up with better ideas for everybody. Right now, it's looking like it's going to be a food fight. I hope that we can say, hey, listen, Barbara Boxer, maybe you left out some communities here. Maybe you left out some people here or some ideas. And yet, we honor and respect who you are and who you're trying to be, and we want you to be even greater by including some of this stuff, as opposed to saying you're a racist and a fool for leaving it out. There's just got to be some way for us to have an honest conversation that still stays on that higher ground.
All right.
Thank you. And I think we're going to move on now to Julian's outro.
All right. Thank you so much. All right. Well, I want to thank everybody for joining us today. And I want to thank those who sent questions for your questions, really insightful questions, and I think they're the kind of questions that we need to work together to find the answers for as we move forward, to make sure that we are communicating our demands and our needs effectively. And I want to apologize to those who, if we weren't able to get to your question because of the time constraints, I want to apologize to that, and hopefully we will be able to help you with those offline when we're done with this call and as we move forward. It's very important that we continue this dialogue, whether it's in this format with a giant 300-person call. Hopefully we can also organize smaller calls. So what I wanted to talk about just really briefly are some next steps and some tools that we'd like to provide in the coming weeks. Before the end of this week, probably Thursday, we're going to be sending out kind of a recap of this call, talking points regarding climate change legislation, communicating what needs to be present in any sort of climate change legislation, as well as a general toolkit on how to break into your local media market, talk to editorial boards, get on the radio, get on TV, and some of the general things that just help to be able to get that message out there and to make sure that we are being proactive instead of reactive in terms of communicating our ideals and demands. So that will be coming later this week. We are also going to be sending some help and guidance to put together in terms of kind of parroting what Jason was saying and working on a local community level We call them solution salons. They're basically community-based educational tools, bringing people in your immediate community together to discuss what we've been talking about today, to discuss what's going on locally, who's doing work on green jobs from various industries, from various organizations. We feel that it's really important to keep this dialogue going on a real local level and then kind of tying it together nationally. So you can expect a solution salon, some guidance in the toolkit on that. And I also want to reiterate, we want to provide toolkits, but we also want to have a dialogue in the back and forth, and we want to stay in close communication with people to help facilitate the creation of solution salons, to facilitate getting into your media market as we are able to do that. I also want to encourage people to go to the resources part of the Green for All webpage, which is going to be expanding as we create this community of practice, as we as we expand our message and expand our reach. We want to make sure that we are kind of reporting back to each other as a community and making sure that we're sharing those best practices. And really the resources page is going to be, the content is going to be provided on everyone, from everyone on this call and others. So I want to encourage all of you to email me with your stories so that we can get good models out and things that are working in communities so that we can share those with other communities and work together to ensure that this happens. It's going to happen on a local, regional, state, and national level if it's going to happen at all, and we're responsible for that.
And by the way, if anybody has ideas, again, we thought we'd be lucky to get 20 people on the phone call, and it turned out there's a big interest out here. If anybody has any ideas about how to do smaller conference calls, how we can really kind of get the dialogue, the pair and share going. Again, within a week you're going to get some support from us. But our main view is that we definitely Jason, Van, Matt Fahm, Julian, we don't think that we're the experts and know everything. I hope we communicate that clearly. We're learning as we go. We're just trying to take some initiative to get us all helping each other. And if anybody's got any technological tricks or tools or any ideas, shoot those along with us. Give us a little bit of evaluation so we can take these hours and use them maximally for everybody.
Yeah. And if people don't have my email, it's Julian, Julian, @greenforall.org. Feel free to send me questions. And like I said, also, stories, best practices, information that we may not have covered on this call that you feel is important to disseminate. And we will do that. And I believe that's what I have for now. And just to also, there's going to be much more that we're going to be trying to do in the coming weeks and months. And we're still, we're looking for ideas from others that are doing things already so that we can get that out there.
Let me just add, Julian, that we very intentionally did not send out a summary of Senator Boxer's amendment to Warner Lieberman before this call, just because we didn't want folks to get bogged down in the wonky details. But
we will provide those wonky details.
Rest assured, for those of you who are secret and not-so-secret wonks, we will send that out with the toolkit that goes out on Thursday.
Yes. Thank you, Jason. Great. Okay.
Thank you all very much. I really appreciate everybody's time and attention, and we will keep everybody updated. Oh, by the way, once the sparks start flying, y'all will be getting updates from us about what's really, really so. And hopefully people can update us and we can keep the information going.
All right. Thank you all very much. Have a good day.
This officially ends our call. Thank you and have a great afternoon.